Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the program. Brian Diaz here with you. Welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City. Yes, friends, pardon me, pardon you, pardon yourself. I'm not sure if you can do that. We've got a really good show for you here today on the NOLA Drinks Show, and as you might be able to tell by the noise in the background, we are on location, as we often do, and yes, we are here at Old Rail Brewing Company in Old Mandeville. It's great. It's right by my house. Since people are not recommending that we go out and drive, we're recording, if you're listening on the radio, we recorded this yesterday, so this was a hop, skip, and a jump from the house, and just avoiding ice patches in the front yard. All is good, and we are here with our beer correspondents, unpaid, as I like to say, Sal Mortellaro,
Hi.
Certified beer judge. Buddy, how you doing, man?
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having us back. Glad to be here again.
Absolutely, man. And I know and I appreciate you being here because as we were talking before, I know you had a bit of a rough day, man, so it's turning around, I hope.
It is. It's good to sit here and talk about beer and drink beer, and that makes up for it all.
Right on. Excellent. So Sal, who's a certified beer judge here in the state of Louisiana, and I know that licensing and that certification carries on beyond that, but we're also chatting with our good pal, Matt Horney, who is the brewmaster and a certified beer judge in his own right here at Old Rail. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for hosting here at Old Rail. It's always always a pleasure to be here. Now, Matt, you just got back. You did some holiday travels.
Yeah, I did. I went back home to Michigan, spent about a week there. It was extremely cold, but now we're because it was about this clear. So you did
some conditioning to come back to this,
right? Yeah, actually,
I like that silver lining.
Yeah, I definitely didn't bring it back with me.
You didn't bring it. Yeah, thanks, buddy. Why don't you go back to Michigan? Well, Matt, extremely well done. So, Matt, you were while you were there, you did get a chance to go out and taste some stuff. What were your impressions of when you went back home? What'd you taste and what'd you see on the scene?
There's a lot of new stuff. There's a lot of new breweries popping up, kind of like down here. It's still happening up there. I did make it out right down the street from my parents' house, probably about 15 minutes away, is Old Nation, which has gained a lot of popularity across the country for their New England IPA.
Do we have those beers in Louisiana? I'm not familiar with them.
No.
Okay.
Well, if you want sort of the style, then you would go to like Parrish or Juicifer from Gnarly Barley, like that.
Gotcha.
Kind of the juicy IPAs, the hazy IPA. Their IPA and the M43 really took off. It's been, you know, on a lot of beer trading sites, a lot of people are seeking it out and going after it and stuff like that. So I know the majority of their sales of all their beer now is concentrated on M43. That's what they're making a lot of. So we went over there and checked that out. We went to a new little brew pub in my hometown in Howell.
Where is Howell roughly for in relation to say like Howell, Detroit or
Howell's about 5 miles west of Detroit.
Okay.
About 30 miles directly north of Ann Arbor.
Gotcha.
So we got a pretty good beer scene just locally, just around there. I know there's probably about 3 breweries within the Howell area, and then there's Old Nation, which is right down the street, and then in Lansing, which is further to the west, there's some breweries that have opened up there that are pretty nice. And then, of course, if you go to Ann Arbor and then on to Detroit, you're going to find a lot of things there. So,
yeah, okay.
It's pretty happening.
That's pretty cool. So, and you were there for a week or so?
About 10 days.
Yeah, right on. Cool.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about you, Sal, man? What'd you do for the holidays? And tie that into beer for me, friend.
Stayed around. We did. My family is very bizarre, very strange. We actually ended up having, I had Chinese food twice on Christmas. We went to a local Chinese buffet and actually stumbled across restaurants in New Orleans.
Oh, on St. Claude.
Yes,
great
they were
place.
Fantastic. Did their price fix menu.
Yeah.
They actually, to back off beer for a second, I was very impressed by their mixed cocktails, their mixed drinks. They really did some good stuff for your listeners if you've never been to Red's Chinese. Not only am I a beer guy, I love food. I'm very much a foodie. And they definitely made an impression on me. So if you haven't been there, I definitely recommend Red's.
It's a great place. You know, one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, they're certainly non-traditional Chinese. It's sort of Chinese by way of New Orleans and a little bit of sort of Creole influence and that sort of thing. And one of the things that I noticed, we've been there a few times, that when you go and you look, and you go, oh, the prices are a little high for Chinese food per plate. They do not skimp on the portions at Red's Chinese.
They do not. They did not.
Yeah, we ordered like 5 things, and we came home with like 5 buckets of things. Yeah, cool. So that sounds good. Do you get any good holiday beers in you?
I've actually been pretty busy with the holidays. I'm kind of deviating off of beer again a little bit. I'll be up upcoming taking the meat exam. I've been studying for that. So the last several weeks, I've kind of shied away from the beers and really focused on the meads to go add my mead judge certification on top of the beer judge certification. Also done through the BJCP.
Oh, that's handled so that way
part,
too.
Yes, it is part of the organization.
And tell people what the BJCP is if they haven't listened to a previous show.
So the BJCP is the Beer Judge Certification Program. It is a worldwide organization that is the gold standard for certifying beer judges. They've been around since 1985. There's approximately 7,000 certified beer judges throughout the world. The vast majority of what they judge is a lot of homebrew competitions, but the higher-ranked judges have the opportunity to judge things such as the World Beer Cup, the Great American Beer Fest, those larger competitions.
And opportunities to also review beers, right? I mean, they kind of look for that as a source for beer reviewers.
Yes. So there is the Beer Connoisseur magazine, which I am also associated with. As a national-ranked BJCP judge, I have had the opportunity to get brought on with the Beer Connoisseur magazine and be part of their blind review panel for beers for breweries throughout the United States.
Gotcha. And Matt, I know you're mm-hmm. a certified judge with BJCP as well. And also, I said this obviously introducing you at the beginning, you are the brewmaster here at Old Rail. Mm-hmm. What we're doing here, guys, is we're establishing your credentials to talk about this stuff on the show. Not that we haven't done that before. I didn't just pull you off the street and say, hey, come in and talk about beer. But yeah, you've been, and just briefly, because we've talked about this before, Matt, but tell people about your background and how you're here at Rail.
Yeah, like we were talking, my family's in Michigan. That's where I grew up. I went to Michigan State, actually graduated with a landscape architecture degree there, and moved to Atlanta, where I segued from landscape architecture into brewing. I started home brewing up in Michigan.
That's an interesting segue.
Yeah, things happen. But started home brewing in Michigan, brought that all down to Atlanta, fall in with a group of home brewers, and we got put a homebrew club together and all that, and study for the BJCP, got our judging credentials, and hosted some homebrew competitions, and one thing led to another, and put a resume together, and ended up down here at Abita, and left Abita and went to Terrapin Beer Company in Athens, Georgia, brewed there for a little bit, and then got this gig here and been here ever since.
Cool. You know, I didn't actually know that part, that you had started out more from the home. I knew mm-hmm. the home brew part, but I didn't know the part about judging and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. and organizing competitions. So that's pretty cool. Well, you guys, one of the things that we're meant to talk about is that, you know, here we are given in the time of year, and here we are given the temperature outside, which is reasonably cold mm-hmm. today, especially for this part of the world. We're going to talk about winter beers and probably have a little bit of time to touch on Mardi Gras mm-hmm. beers. And, you know, one of the things that we'll get to that, Sal, thanks for passing me that note, is that, you did spend a week, Matt, in Germany.
I did.
Yeah. And I think, did we not talk about that a little? Had you not just come back from there or no? I don't think so last time.
Yeah, we never got there. Yep.
So let's do that. So, you know, we're going to talk about the winter beers and stuff like that. And why don't you tell us, we got about a minute, guys, before we're going to take a break here. So why don't we tee up this trip to Germany? Because you were there, it was a little bit after Oktoberfest was technically over, right?
Yeah, I think it finished up about a week after Oktoberfest, or we got there after about a week after Oktoberfest.
So did you get anything beyond the spittle, I guess, would be my...
There was nothing left. There was no Oktoberfest beer left. So we tried to find it. We hunted some down, and we could not acquire any of it.
So you drained it out, huh?
Yeah, it was gone.
It's gone when it's gone.
It was gone, yeah.
Okay. Let's do this, you guys. We're going to take a little break here on the show, and we're going to come back. We'll touch on your trip to Germany, because that'd be cool. I didn't realize we hadn't caught up on that. And then we will get to our topic of the day, which is winter beers. Friends, we're here. Noah Drink Show. Brian Diaz with you. Old Rail Brewing Company in Old Mandeville. We're going to take a little break. Come on back.
Give me a great big glass of wine. I'm going to sit at the bar, because the floor show starts at 9. Give me a great big glass of wine.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass wine you drink.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's Bar Bar Sips and Snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning in, friends, as always, to the show. And as we do about once a quarter or so, we get Sal and Matt together, our local beer residents, and as I mentioned before, our beer correspondents, the beer guys, unpaid position, fellas, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I apologize for that every time.
It's all right. We get to drink beer and talk about it.
There
so.
You go. And, hey, Matt and Sal, you always get that response. I appreciate that. We're setting that as a routine. So here we are. And we left off at the break, guys, and we were piecing this back together, Matt. The last time I saw you, we talked about your trip to Germany, but we weren't doing the show. And last time we did the show here, you were just about to embark on your trip to Germany. So post-Oktoberfest, you went there for a little bit. Tell us about it, man.
Yeah. So that was it was the first trip to Germany. I went with Owen Ogletree, who some may know is a very well-known beer expert from Atlanta or Athens, Georgia. And he does this frequently. I think he's going to South Africa on his next trip, and I'll probably be joining him again for a Belgian trip next fall. But yeah, we spent a very fast-paced week in Germany, and it was fast. It was.
Did you go to Munich, or where did you go?
Yeah, we started in Munich. Okay. We went to Bamberg and then came back to Munich. And let me tell you, it was something else. It was from 9 a.m. to 9 o'clock at night, beer all day long. And good beer. But Munich was a lot of fun. Did our kind of like little day hikes around Munich, and we went to a lot of the kind of Munich hotspots and tried a lot of Hefeweizens, a lot of Munich Helles that we even, you know, been trying to kind of hone that in here at the brewery, at the pub, and a lot of Dunkels and, you know, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Just trying them in Germany and having them fresh from the sources was amazing. I can't even begin to explain what it's like to just have these beers so fresh.
I know one of the things that you do here, Matt, at Old Rail, which I respect and appreciate a lot, is that when you're making a particular style of beer, you try and stay true to the process, the water composition, and so on and so forth of the beer. Was this an eye-opening experience, or how did that revelatory? How did that work?
Yeah, some of the breweries we went to, an Abbey brewery that brews to the the purity law in Germany, the Rheinheitsgebot. And learning what they do there and other breweries around Germany as far as decoction mashing, following some of these methods that a lot of people hear.
Tell people what that means.
So decoction mashing is you start off with a normal mash. You have your grain, your water mixed together. And then you draw off some of that grain and you put it into another kettle and you heat that up through the phases of its rest, its temperatures. And then you bring it to a boil and you get what's called kettle caramelization in there. You add that back into the main mash and then it raises the temperature up to the next mash rest level. and then you might do it again, and you might do it again. You can do a double decoction or a triple decoction. But what it does is it gives a lot more character to these beers. And you can't achieve that through adding different kinds of grains. It's just something that's a byproduct of that method, and that's an old method.
Well, you're kind of mm-hmm. this is exactly what I was going to ask, Matt. Thank you. Is that so? If we're dealing with the German purity law, mm-hmm. the number of ingredients that you can use is extremely limited. So your variation, your artistry is based on your process, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't be adding any fruits. You wouldn't be adding any anything outside of the yeast, hops, malt, water. Anything outside of that is not allowed.
So it's the artistry of the process then, and then personalize the process or customize the process.
Right. And one of the places we went to was Weinstephan Brewery, the oldest brewery in the world, the oldest beer school in the world. And seeing that place and walking through that place was like you've reached the pinnacle of beer. This is like almost the birthplace of beer. And they do decoction mashes, and this is a very large brewery. But they do it, and they've been doing it for a very long time, and a lot of their beers have been perfected and honed and researched, and it was just a really impressive place to go. Bomberg, which is pretty much well known for their smoke beers.
What does that mean?
Smoke beer, so that's smoked malt. It goes back into the history of just the early days of beer. This is like a long time ago, where the malt process was a lot different. And kilning the malt, you would leach in some of these aromatics from some of the woods that were used to reach the temperatures you needed to come up with your final product for your malt. In simple terms.
Does that differ from toasted malt, or is that a variation of toasting the malt?
It's basically just the general, like if you wanted a base malt, a pale malt, it would be smoked. It would end up with this tinge of smoke in it. No matter what it was, it's just the process. Because they didn't have natural gas, they didn't have anything other than wood to use to do this process. So there's only two places in the world that still do this, and they're in Germany. And there's maltsters that will provide you a smoked malt, but they're just not the same. They're it's not their precise little niche that they focus on. So we went to Schlenkerla pub, and we went through their smoked beers. And I gotta say, me and Sal did some tests at his place, and we tasted a U.S. purchased Schlenkerla beer. I believe we had the Marzen.
Yep,
and
is Martin a typical example of a smoke?
No, not
necessarily.
No,
okay, mm-hmm. okay.
No, it's just their version of that style,
right? Okay,
in a smoked version. So we put that up against a bottle that I had brought back from Germany, and night and day difference. You know, I've never been huge on smoked beer, and now I know why, because I've never had one that was actually from. Well, they were from Germany, but not truly fresh from Germany.
And made to that standard.
Yeah. And the smoked flavor was just well-rounded. You could drink it all day. It was a great beer. It was amazing.
There are some smoked beers available on the market here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you can get them here. But, you know, it's that thing. You'll enjoy it if you get it. It'll be a smoked beer, and it's going to be good. And it's from one of the most reputable smoked beer breweries in the world.
What would be an example just for listeners to like that's available here?
That you could get, I think you can probably get Schlenkerla beer here.
I know on the North Shore you can definitely get it at Cuesta Paces. For your South Shore folks, you can definitely get it over at Stein's Deli.
Okay.
They're phenomenal beers. That's probably, as you said, it's probably the key, the gold standard when it comes to smoked beers is Schlenkerla out of Bamberg, Germany. It's very rare to see a commercial version of it because it is very much an acquired taste, and not a lot of people do it as a result. But that is kind of what they have made their history on, is that beer. It's probably, if you have a smoked beer, it's probably going to come from them.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
So they do smoke all their own malt there.
Yes.
So it's not purchased from a malt supplier and pre-smoked. They actually control the whole entire process. And no other brewery really does that. So
interesting.
So if you get a smoked beer from any other brewery outside of Bomberg, then it's it's likely, it could be smoked. We could smoke malt here if we wanted to, but we won't achieve the level of quality that they can achieve.
Because they're doing it all in-house, a state process.
Yeah, they've been around for, it's been hundreds and hundreds of years, and that brewery's gone through transitions from family to family to family. And one of the interesting things that we learned there was that breweries were treated like a royal family. You intermarried one of your children into another brewery's family, so you could interconnect the two and keep the tradition alive by just kind of extending families from brewery to brewery to brewery.
And I'm imagining even keeping some things proprietary, right? That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. You guys, let's do this. Let's take a little break here on the show. And it's always, I love talking to you guys because it's always fascinating to talk about beers. We'll get ourselves to winter beers, but that was really, thank you, Matt, for sharing that with us. That's really cool. We're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show, friends. Come on back.
French Market is open daily with pop-up fresh markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays. The Crescent City Farmers Market is at the French Market each Wednesday, rain or shine, from 2 to 6 p.m. On Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., find new and different vendors offering everything from fresh bagels to fresh herbs. Vendors change weekly depending on weather and seasons, so check them out often. Visit frenchmarket.org for a list of farmers market vendors, chef demonstrations, live music, and special events.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature made the Sazerac cocktail the official cocktail of New Orleans, affirming what New Orleanians had known for over 150 years. You just can't beat a good Sazerac. The Sazerac cocktail is the quintessential New Orleans drink, perfect for celebrating the arrival of fall festivals, football season, or just being proud to be a New Orleanian. For the official recipe, visit www.sazerac.com.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill and Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening to the show. As always, my friends, happy to be here chatting with my friends, Sal and Matt. Sal Mortilaro, certified beer judge, and Matt Horney, also certified beer judge, brewmaster here at Old Rail Brewing Company. And I love talking to you guys. We talked about this. We were just talking about this during the break. You know, we always sort of set up a theme, and then we deviate from the theme every time, which is great. It was awesome, and I love what you were talking about, Matt, your trip to Germany. Fascinating stuff. Sal, we'll certainly do a show on mead especially after you go do your meat exam in Austin. But one of the things that we sort of teed up coming into this show was talking about winter beers because it's cold and it's winter. So let's talk about some winter beers. So I'll kick this to you. Traditional stuff, right? We're kind of heavier, we're kind of darker, maybe a little more alcohol.
Absolutely. you know, as it gets colder, you need something to warm you up.
Right.
Traditionally, you're going to go for these darker beers. Look for beers such as these nice Imperial Porters or these Russian Imperial Milk Stouts, or I'm sorry, Russian Imperial Stouts. Also, one of my favorite styles out there, probably my hands-down favorite style, is a barley wine. Now, there's English barley wines, there's American barley wines, but these are going to be beers with ABVs. These are going to be dark, deep, rich, very satiating beers where a couple of sips will do you good.
Sal, do me a favor. Tell people, because the way you make a barley wine, let's differentiate barley wine from what we would think of most beers.
So they call it barley wine because they are a higher ABV beer. These style beers are your lower end acceptable barley wine is going to be 8%. All the way up to 12% alcohol. Some of them even, some of these smaller microbreweries, it's not unheard of that they may push into the 14% range.
Yeah, I was not aware that even 8% was in the game. I thought it was always higher than that. That's interesting.
So without getting too technical, some of these beers, you have what's called an English strong ale. The lower end of the barley wine can actually overlap with the higher end of the English strong ales. But 8% is 8 to 12% is considered about average acceptable for a barley wine.
Okay.
You're going to have two different schools of barley wine, if you will. You're going to have the English style, which is going to be much more malt focused, good malty, relatively sweet, very rich beer, thick mouthfeel. A lot of these bread crusts, dried fruits, dark fruits. And then you're going to have the American barley wine, which is the American version of it. The quick version is just add more hops to it and make it more hoppy. But that is a relative term because even on the English style, it is going to be a very hoppy beer. It has to balance out that amount of malt.
It is very malty, right?
Yes.
And where does the sweetness come from? Residual sugar? Where does that...
So, yes, what happens is that you have to start with a pretty high starting gravity is what the term is, the amount of dissolved sugar in the water. And with that, the yeast are going to eat a certain percentage of that sugar.
Right.
And you're going to be left with, when they eat that sugar, they, of course, make the alcohol. There's going to be a certain percentage of sugar left. It's generally going to be these more complex sugars that provide mouthfeel and still now, sweet now, to us.
Sal, is it such where, so does the yeast commit suicide, essentially?
They really honestly do.
Yeah.
They gorge themselves to death. They just want to eat,
off
and eventually
that sugar, the alcohol gets too high and they die.
You got it, much. Yeah. They're self-destructive, but that residual sugar.
And we thank them
left,
for
yes.
their sacrifice. Yeah.
And we yes, absolutely.
They're having a good time doing it.
Yes, they are.
Go down swinging, baby. Go on, Sal. Sorry.
But no worries. Actually, here at Old Rail, they do a fantastic barley wine, a barrel-aged barley wine. We're sitting here drinking their barrel-aged Russian Imperial Stout. Also a very big beer, roasty. They age these in, is it Woodford?
We did Old Forester on this.
Old Forester
bourbon
barrels. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Yep.
So nice, rich, roasty beer, warm you up. What's ABV on this one?
We keep it a little bit low just because we want it to be on the drinkable end. So this is about 8.2%.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But now, why, Matt, is this? Why is it called a Russian Imperial Stout? How would that differentiate from other stouts?
The Russian Imperial. So you have your what is it? You have an Imperial Stout, and then you have your Russian Imperial Stout.
Correct.
The Russian Imperial, the Russian tie. Sal can tell you more about that, but that actually ties back into. What was it? That goes back to Russia, doesn't
back,
it?
Right, yeah. That goes back to when Russia, when they were courting the East. I'm sorry, excuse me.
Courting the West.
Courting the West.
Okay.
And they came back and they just enjoyed these English beers, the stouts. Of course, they wanted to do it bigger. They wanted to do it better. And even the Russian Imperial style is a very broad style. Mm-hmm. You can get anywhere from a sweet Russian Imperial stout, which has a lot of these very dark stone fruits, plums, and things along those lines, all the way from that side of the spectrum, all the way to these very roasty, big, almost acrid style mm-hmm. stout. So it's a very broadly interpreted style as a whole. Also, these two can get up to 12%, which is considered acceptable for the style.
Sure. Okay. And so, Matt, you were gunning for something here a little bit lower. Keep it about 8% or so.
Yeah. Yeah. And like our barley wine, that's at 10.3. And actually, this barley wine, I think we did bring this up a little bit. We did change it this year. Normally, for the past few years, we've kept it at about 8.2, and this one I think we've gone up to near 9, just because I think that gives a little bit more complexity, gives it a little bit more character, because alcohol is considered a flavor.
Sure.
So bringing that up a little bit did kind of change a little bit, which I like. This is probably my favorite batch that we've done so far, and
it's great, man. And you call it the Dark Territory, right?
Dark Territory. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Where does the name come from there?
So Dark Territory is a train term, and that goes back to when trains would lose communications before they had advanced communication. They communicated by lights and signals and things like that. And then stretches out west where you had large expanses of train track, there would be no lights, there would be nothing out there. And so once you entered into Dark Territory, you were kind of on your own. So you kind of just hoped that another train wasn't coming in your direction.
Yeah, good luck. right on. So now what we're kind of getting at here with winter beers, which I think, you know, it's sort of somewhat obvious, but heavier beers, as we talked about, hearty beers, I'll use
sure.
that term,
yep.
a little bit higher in alcohol, mm-hmm. which makes a lot of sense. Aside from barley wine and stout, Sal, you mentioned porters.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And tell us a little bit about porter.
So the porter is also an English style. There's a little bit of debate which came first, the porter or the stout. There's some terminology where they call it, I believe it's the strong porter or the strong stout. It is a little bit going to be a little bit more of a roastier style. It's traditionally English. There's a few imperial porters, Gnarly Barley out of Hammond. They do a imperial milk porter.
And what does imperial mean in that sense?
Imperial denotes the amount of... it's a very generic term in the beer world. Imperial will generally denote a higher alcohol, higher starting gravity beer.
Got it.
So the quick down and dirty rule of thumb is if you see a beer out there with imperial, an imperial stout or an imperial porter, these imperial darker beers, this is probably what you're going to want to go for.
So slightly up on the alcohol gradient.
Correct.
Compared to a non.
Correct.
Okay,
yes.
Gotcha. Okay, got it. So what differentiates, we've got about a minute, you guys, before we're going to take a break, but what differentiates a porter from a stout?
Generally, what's called the grist or the malt bill, the grain additions that are added, there's going to be, like I said, they're going to be a little roastier, a little bit more residual body. Generally, stouts are a little bit drier. You have the Irish dry stout. These are going to be beers that are roastier. And not as chocolate derived. Your stouts are going to be a little more chocolatey. Your porters are going to be a little bit more roasty.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. That actually puts it in a good context. You guys, let's do this. Let's take a little bit of a break here on the show. We're going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about winter brews. We promise to get into, because next time you guys are going to be on, it's probably going to be after Mardi Gras, which is coming up pretty quick here, February 13th, as we know. So we're going to probably touch on Mardi Gras beers in a very limited fashion and talk a little bit more about some other beers. We're here at Old Rail. We're chatting with Matt and Sal, the beer guys, our beer correspondents. Sorry, no paycheck, boys. Come on back.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're going to stay here till we soothe our soul. If it takes all night long. Talking it might be three. Time doesn't mean that much to me. Ain't felt this way since I don't know when. Don't
Hey ladies, are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello Wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, Dessert Wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello Wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Baggio heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Well, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Well, I'm standing on a corner with the bucket in my hand. I'm just looking for a woman that ain't got no man. My bucket's got a hole in it. Yeah, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole in it. I can't buy no beer. Yes, I went up on a mine.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the program. Brian Deese here at WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans. Thanks for tuning in today. As always, and we are chatting with Sal Mortilaro and Matt Horney, and we're talking about beers. Two of the most knowledgeable beer guys that I know. Always a pleasure, guys, to talk beers with you. And as I said before, one of my favorite things is that we ostensibly plan a theme, and then we talk about the theme most of the time, but then we deviate into so much because you guys know so much about beer, and it's great, and we all love beer, so that's a cool thing. So, Sal, we wanted to clean up something from the last, we were talking about porter and stout.
Correct, yeah, so before we went to the break, I realized it after I said it, but as you noted, it's been a very calamity-filled day for me, so I realized my brain fart after. The porter, not the stout, the porter is going to be your more chocolatey beer, a little bit easier drinking, whereas your stout is going to be the roastier, the drier. Back in England, when they did the porters, the strong porter was called the stout porter, the strong porter. So just for clarification, I caught myself after I said it, your porter is going to be that chocolatier, easier drinking beer. Your stout is going to be a little drier, a little more roasty notes, acrid, that kind of thing.
Sure, that makes sense. Now, Matt, when you're approaching doing porters and stouts, because obviously we're here in Louisiana, and I know you like to stay true to style, but we are outside of this particular several set of days or past month, we're in a warmer climate. Does that change, like with the dark territory that I'm drinking right now, hence why a little bit lower ABV, does that influence your thinking?
You know, with that beer, actually with the drinkability of it, that's a beer that we get requested all year round. So it could be 90 degrees outside and people ask when's dark territory.
Yeah. You guys have good air conditioning in here, by the way. I mean.
We can make it feel like winter in here, everyone. Yeah, the lower ABV, I kind of just specifically did that because I was so used to having those 12% and those 14% ones, and I could just like take like a couple sips of it, and then I would set it down and move on to something else. And I was like, man, I just want to have like a really nice, you know, Russian Imperial Stout that I could have a nice glass of and just sit and maybe have another one. But it's just one of those things to where drinkability is what you want, but you want to create the essence of a big beer, but keep the ABV down on it. And I think we kind of captured that in that. It does have that really robust, it has that Imperial Stout character, and when you add the barrel aging onto it, I think the booziness that you get from the barrel kind of makes it feel bigger than it really is.
That makes sense. And it kind of segues nicely, guys, into what we wanted to talk about here in the last segment is just since we're not going to have you all on until after Mardi Gras again, talking about Mardi Gras beers. And so, you know, if you're going to be out on a parade route, for example, there are certain considerations. And if you're going to sit out there on Bacchus Sunday and you're going to be out for 10 or 12 hours, a little bit lower ABV can be a good thing.
Sure. Actually, you know, so one of my favorite beers out there, kind of segueing in between Mardi Gras and these porters, there is a brewery out of Salt Lake City, Utah, called Wasatch Brewing.
Yeah, sure.
And what's very unique about these guys is because they are in Utah, which is a strange state and a strange area to begin with, most of their beers are at 4% alcohol.
We're going to let all that go, but yeah, fair enough. No offense to our friends in Utah.
They do. Oh, that's right. We're worldwide listening. Hey,
We're going to let our freakish friends in Park City just be as they are. So,
but I am giving their city and their brewery some love. So we got that. Wasatch Brewing out of Salt Lake, but because they're in that neck of the woods, most of their beers are going to be in the 4% range, and they do a beer called, ironically, Polygamy Porter is the name of it. Because
shameless.
You can't.
Okay, there we go. We're going down that hole. Go, baby.
You can't. No. And their tagline is, "You can't have just one." I'm not making it up. I'm just the messenger here. But this is, you can find this particular beer, Polygamy Porter, Wasatch Brewing. You can find it at Whole Foods, Aquista Paces. You can find it at Stein's. Very easy, very drinkable. It actually shows what you can do with a good, proper malt bill, that you don't need these high crazy alcohol make a
4%
flavorful
sal on a porter.
Yes, 4%. This is below Budweiser. I think Budweiser is at 4.5%.
Yeah.
It just shows what you can do with a proper use of malt, a good malt bill, and make a good proper tasty porter that you can drink all day. So you get the winter roastiness, right? But yet that quaffable, sessionable, easy drinking.
Now let me
beer.
Ask you this question, because you know we don't know what the weather's going to look like on Mardi Gras on the 13th. So often lately we've been a little bit cold. I'm going to guess that that beer is like many of these beers. This is going to be good and drinkable at ambient temperature. Don't need to drag a cooler out, right? I mean, you're going to be okay at drinking the beer at 60 degrees.
Right. Yeah. You'll be all right. Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. That's cool. So you guys, a couple other quick considerations for Mardi Gras beers, because this is sort of what we're talking about. Can't have glass.
Sure.
So we're looking at canned stuff.
Right.
Right.
Yep. So a lot of the breweries that are popping up around New Orleans are starting to get into canning or growlers to go. It's a cross between a can and a growler, a crawler to go. I know that Parlo Beer Lab just got their hands on one. Brewcare down in the French Quarter just got their hands on one. Wayward Owl has one. So you can hit up your local favorite craft brewery in New Orleans, and more than likely you can find a crawler to go of your favorite local beer.
That works great. So you guys, anything else that we want to talk about Mardi Gras beer wise? I mean, this is sort of what we're trying to talk about. And for listeners that are not from around here, you can celebrate. We're in carnival season. You can celebrate carnival anywhere that you are. But kind of what we're trying to get at is portability. You're going to be out all day, so a little bit of lower ABV consideration, but ambient temperature. So you're not dragging an ice chest out there.
Yeah. You know, and I'm going to throw it back to Michigan a little bit and say the all-day IPA from Founders.
Okay. And we can get that here.
Yeah, you can get that here, and that comes in cans. But that's just a good old staple beer. It's become a good old staple beer now for just kind of like all-day drinking. I mean, it literally is the all-day IPA. So that's something to, you know, I would probably go to, and you could probably drink that at ambient temperature. I'm sure that would be fine.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that makes it nice and easy. So you guys, we got about a minute or so left, minute and a half left. Tell people about, Sal, tell people quickly about BJCP. Where website or Facebook finding
so
out about that.
Sure. We have the national website is bjcp.org, as in Beer Judge Certification Program.org. If you're on Facebook, you can find them on Facebook. You can actually also find us, the Louisiana BJCP group. It's going to be kind of a clearinghouse for all things BJCP, exams, tests coming up, competitions coming up, ways to judge, how to get involved. So check us out there as well.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Matt? Tell people where they can find you here at Old Rail Brewing Company.
Yeah, so we're in Old Mandeville across from the street from the St. Tammany Trace Trailhead. We're on 639 Gerard Street. What, about 2 miles from the causeway?
Yeah, nice and easy if you're coming from the South Shore.
Yeah, and so the kind of new things that we have going on right now, we do have a website. It
Very
does
nice.
Need...
It's been a while in coming. Okay, cool.
It's been a little bit prematurely released, so we need some menu updates and some beer menu updates. We're actually tying that into the Untappd app, so if you have that, our menu online will now coincide with that once we get that connected. But that's oldrailbrewing.com. We also do now have a connection with Facebook. If you're on a computer and you go to Old Rail's Facebook page, we now have that connected on tap. So I try my best to keep it updated as much as possible. It's usually a couple days after a beer comes out, it'll come too. But that's right now the most accurate place to find our online menu.
Awesome. Thanks, you guys. And Sal, I just said, we know that Matt's one of the finest beer makers in the state, if not the finest beer maker in the state.
I agree.
Right?
Fair
enough. So, friends, come check out Old Rail Brewing here in Old Mandeville. It is worth the trip. We're going to take the top of the hour break here on the NOLA Drink Show. When we come back from the top of the hour, we're going to be chatting with Jill Benson, who is the Director of Culinary Programming at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We're going to talk about the SOFAB. It is SOFAB, the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We're going to talk about her new cookbook as well and a few other things. So, friends, stick around for the second hour of the NOLA Drink Show. Really appreciate it. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land. Come on back.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Night before last, I got loaded on a bottle of whiskey. On a bottle of whiskey. Night before last, I got loaded on a bottle of whiskey. On a bottle of whiskey. Though I feel all right.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with the WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. As always, friends, thanks for tuning into the show here today. I appreciate it. A special treat for you. As you know, we are here on location as we do, and we are here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum here in New Orleans, obviously, and I'm pleased to be joined by Jill Benson, who is the Director of Culinary Programming here at the museum, but also author and culinary historian and many things. So, Jill, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to meet you. And let's talk a little bit. You're a culinary historian, and you also run the programming here. Tell us a little bit about what you do and how you got involved with the museum.
It feels kind of funny to refer to myself as a culinary historian because I work with Liz Williams, and she really is kind of the master culinary historian.
And she's
so
the director
I'll
here,
just
right?
call myself... a junior culinary historian. I know a lot, but I know what I don't know. But I'm willing to say Liz Williams knows everything. So yeah, she's the number one source. And it's really an honor to work with someone who's been a mentor to me for a long time and to so many other people. Mm-hmm. And then in return here at the museum, I serve as a mentor to other people. Among the many things I do here, I'm responsible for shepherding our culinary entrepreneurs, and that's everything from, you know, some young students just out of culinary school who are trying to figure out what it is that they're doing, and they want to do some pop-ups, or they just need some practice, or trying to figure out how to work in front of a camera. So I handle our kitchen here, our test kitchen, which is 1,300 square feet, and it's a spectacular space. It's outfitted by, you know, All of our equipment is Jennaire's top of the line products. Mm-hmm. And then we have lots of KitchenAid equipment. So it's a great place to work. It's really beautiful. We have lots of natural light. So we, our entrepreneurs, they, it's a licensed commercial commissary. So I'm the one with the license to run the commissary. So all of these guys need a commissary to work out of. So they come to us and we, this is everything from the guy, like I said, the kid just getting out of culinary school to the guy who's been an attorney. He's tired of it. And, you know, he wants to be a pickle maker at the farmer's market. And if you think that, I think that guy's not out there, he is. Uh-huh. So we have all kinds of people who come to us and, you know, we set them up with a space. We help to get them connected in the community, help them with some marketing ideas, outreach. If we have media opportunities that we can plug them into, we do that too.
That's really cool. So say let's take that example. Say I'm the guy that wants to make pickles at the farmer's market. Do I knock on your door and say, help me make pickles at the farmer's market? How does that work?
The best way to find out about us is just to go to our website, and that's mm-hmm. southernfood.org. Or you can also go to natfab.org, natfab.org. That's the National Food and Beverage Foundation, and that's our umbrella organization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can just, we have classes, and we have programming, and we have the Culinary Entrepreneurship Program. And just baseline, the Culinary Entrepreneurship Program is to use our licensed commercial commissary during business hours. It's $25 an hour.
Okay.
So, gotcha. And you know, we have some really great resources for that. We're centrally located. Parking is easy. As we develop closer relationships with entrepreneurs, we really do, you know, tend to give them a lot of free rein over our space and decision making, and we really try to empower them to do what they have to do and to make decisions with themselves.
So you're, not only are you providing a space and the equipment and mm-hmm. area and the commissary to do stuff, but then you are also providing guidance, knowledge, wisdom.
Absolutely. Just this past weekend, and another member of our staff, Pepper Bowen, she handles our culinaria program, which
she will be
is
on the show next week as we just yes. organized.
Well, she's a tremendous resource. Well, she invited some lawyers, some financiers, other types of people who could be of assistance to entrepreneurs, and had them set up in stations around the museum. And entrepreneurs were invited to come in and talk to them if they're looking for a micro lender, or they're just, you know, trying to figure out how to put together a marketing plan, or they need legal advice. That's what we were able to offer them this past weekend. And we have several programs like that every year. And then in addition to that is just what goes on in the commissary kitchen all the time. Perfect example, there's a young man, he's 24 years old. He's a classically trained chef. He's originally from Senegal. And he came here, it's a long story short, but Cliff Rogan with the New Orleans Fish House got to know this young man. His name is Sering Mabe. He also goes by Sering Love, Chef Sering. And he, Cliff met Sering in Senegal. Cliff had gone there to open an orphanage. They met in the airport. Okay. They started talking. And Cliff said, you have to come back to New Orleans. He called Tori McPhail at Commander's Palace and he said, I have a favor. Would you grant this guy an interview? And Tori did. And then he hired him sight unseen.
Wow.
That was about 9 months ago. So Sering came here from Senegal. 9 months to a year.
Had he done his formal training in Senegal?
No, or? he did it in the United States.
Okay,
I want to say it was New England Culinary Institute, but okay. Don't hold me to that.
Sure.
So he started working on the line at Commander's. And or actually, I think he was maybe... he was a low guy on the line. Within 6 months, he was the senior line cook. He has a tremendous, wow. Tremendous work ethic, and he also just has a way of really endearing himself to people. So he was recently promoted to, let's see, he's the nighttime sous chef now at Cafe Adelaide.
Oh, wow.
So, okay. But his real jam is making the connections between what we call Creole food here.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many mother roots to what we call Creole food.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is indisputably the contribution of the enslaved West African people.
Without a doubt.
So if you look at, Sering does pop-ups here with us, and if you look at the food that he is serving at his pop-ups, you can absolutely see that this is so much the root of what we're calling Creole cuisine, as is, you know, the French influences and the Spanish influences, and in some case the Italian influences,
Native American.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there are the Caribbean influences, but those who really don't get credited are the West Africans and what they contributed, and the contributions are indisputable. So that's a big part of Sering's goal, is to really educate people there. And, it's our passion to help him do that, too.
That's great.
So we all work together and we do that. His pop-ups chefs are amazing.
So where is he doing those?
He does them out of the kitchen.
Oh, here.
He does them here.
Okay.
His next one, I've advised him that maybe he should change the date, but he's supposed to be doing one on the evening of January 27th. It's a Saturday. It's also the night of Cour de Vaux. So Suring not being from here may not realize how that could impact his pop-up. So. Right. We'll have a chat about that. But you can always find out what's going on, you know, pop-ups or special events in our kitchen just by going to southernfood.org.
Got it. Well, Jill, tell us a little bit. We got a couple minutes before we have to take a break. But what's your background and how did you end up here?
What is my background?
Did you grow up here in New Orleans? Or?
Yes, I'm from New Orleans. I actually grew up just on the other side of the 17th Street Canal in Old Metairie. And it was just a little too quiet there for me. So when after I finished high school and I was starting school at UNO, I escaped from Old Metairie and I moved to the city and I've been in the city ever since. So I started cooking in self-defense when I was about six. my brother's 17 years older than I am. My sister's 13 years older than I am. And somehow they really weren't hanging around too much with this little kid. So I was bored. My mother was probably Louisiana's only terrible cook. So, but my parents had received, they were married in 1950, and they received a comprehensive collection of, I think it was Good Housekeeping cookbooks.
Oh, yeah.
Which had a lot of great pictures. So as a little kid, I'd just sit there looking at them. And, you know, I was bored and started playing in the kitchen. And then it just, I've always been a writer. And I started off, and when I was still in college, I started working for the Times-Picayune in the editorial department. And I stayed in editorial for about 5 years. And I 25 and arrogant, I figured, you know, oh, hey, you know, healthcare benefits and, you know, a secure package. Who needs that? So I did, you know, I started freelancing for, I was a regional stringer correspondent for Time Magazine and the New York Times.
Oh, okay.
And so it kind of ran around the region. You know, it was really unglamorous. For example, I get a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, hey, a train's derailed in Alabama. You're it. So why don't you just, like, you better boogie on over there.
Get in the car and go.
Yeah.
Well, Jill, do me one favor. We're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to come back and chat a little bit more. Let's hold that thought, because I want to come back and get a little bit more about your background. Then we're, of course, going to talk about your new cookbook, which is really cool. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Dole Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Come on back.
Wine. If she keeps a drinking, she's gonna lose her mind. She's a wine head woman, don't you know? She's a wine head woman, don't you know? I hate to do it, but I just got to let her go. She drinks wine day and she drinks wine night. And when she come home, she wants to fuss and fight. She's a wine head woman, don't you know? She's a wine head woman, don't you know?
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Looking to shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
All All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. We're chatting here with Jill Benson, the Director of Culinary Programming here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum on OCH Aretha Castle Haley. And Jill, you were just telling us a little bit about your background. Where we left things off is you getting in a car in the middle of the night to go cover a train wreck in Alabama.
I know. Isn't that great? Yeah. Just, you know, the glories of working for big news. You know, but it was a lot of fun. I had some incredible experiences. And when I was 27 years old, I found that I was expecting who would ultimately become my daughter. So my husband and I decided it wouldn't be so prudent to just kind of keep running all over the region. Maybe you needed to do something that was a little more, you know, it made a little more sense. So because I had so many contacts in the media and I'm decent at spinning a story, I started an independent PR consultancy, and I ultimately ended up specializing in high-end culinary and hospitality. Most of it was in Louisiana. I worked with some national interests, but I went along my way, and then ultimately through an agency that I contracted to, ended up handling the Galatoire's account. And that was when Galatoire's had, it had been this kind of sleepy older thing. And the agency, which was then Keating McGee, they really brought this local gem back, and they brought, instead of younger generations thinking, oh, this is somewhere I'm going to go to celebrate my grandmother's birthday, they started thinking again, like, hey, it's Friday afternoon, let's go. So I worked with the Galatoire's account for 10 years, and then ultimately ended up with Melvin Rodrigue writing their cookbook, which published, it was for their 100th anniversary in 2005. Lots of things happened in 2005.
Right.
So Random House published that, and that was a really cool experience. So,
that's a great cookbook, by the way.
Thanks. Yeah. It's neat. There are a lot of great stories to tell there. So, but I really wanted to get back. My daughter was older now, and I wanted to get back into the editorial side of things. So I worked for a couple of different magazines and in an editorial capacity. And, what did I do? I mean, I've been the editor of a couple of publications, wrote another cookbook that published in 2015 that was fun, funky, and fabulous, and that focused on what chefs, and Michael Gallant is the perfect example. Mm-hmm. You can see the underpinning of our Creole culinary heritage and what he's doing, but then he's also layering things on top of that. So that book, it was recipe driven, and it just focused on kind of where the next generation's moving.
And just so people that are especially, excuse me, Jill, that are listening to the podcast. So Mike Gallata is the chef, executive chef, and co-owner of Maypop and Mofo.
Yes,
local guy, but he also is bringing a Southeast Asian flair to his food.
His line is where the Mekong meets the Mississippi.
Right.
So,
right.
And there are a lot of people doing that sort of thing. It's just he kind of jumps out at me. Mm-hmm. But that's what that book focused on. And Sam Hanna is an absolutely brilliant photographer. So Sam did all the photography on that book.
Oh, okay.
And that book came out at about the same time I started working with the museum. I've known Liz Williams for a long time. And she has this way of finding people she wants to work with. And then she'll keep saying, well, how about this position? And if that doesn't work for you, she'll say, well, how about this one? No, that's not the right fit either. Well, how about this? And you take over the kitchen and I said, what do you want me to do? And she said, make it marketable.
Oh, that's cool.
Make money. So I said,
it's an interesting challenge.
And
yeah.
It was. And it was all the appliances were in, but otherwise it was pretty bare bones. And I said, well, what do you want me to do here? How do I start? And she said, I don't know, just figure it out.
Was anything going on? Was it just cooking demos occasionally or something?
There was some Saturday afternoon programming, and we continued that, but we weren't teaching formal classes. It was just, the museum had just moved into its permanent home on Aretha Castle Haley. And we had this spectacular kitchen. It's 1,300 square feet. There's lots of seating area for people. If we're seating people in an auditorium fashion, and they might have to really like one another, but we can pack in 125.
Oh,
and if we're seating them at table, if they're cozy, we can probably push it to about 70. So we can accommodate a lot of people. And our goal is to educate people. So it was like somebody handing me the keys to this Learjet, because it's a spectacular kitchen, and saying, here, figure out how to fly this thing. So I started calling on people. I'm very fortunate to have had many mentors in my lives. Kit Wall of Wall & Company. Kit is a spectacular cookbook writer, and She was Al Copeland's publicist. She knows where everybody in town is buried.
Oh, I didn't know. Oh, I didn't know that part.
Oh, yeah. Okay. She's okay. Amazing, and she's still writing, and she's... Kit's incredible. You need to catch up with Kit. But she really mentored me, and there's another woman named Karen Lowry, and she's a personal chef. And those were the two women I really called upon. And Karen came in, and she looked at the space, and she said, okay, you have to do this and move this and fix that and blah, 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 blah. And then Kit really looked at it more from a PR and marketing angle. So one was giving me physical advice, and the other one was giving me marketing advice.
That's
great. And, you know, between the two, yeah, it worked out. You know,
so how long have you been at the museum then, Jill?
When did actually, you, when January is 3 years now.
Okay, great.
So, and we've grown a lot, and we have an amazing team. We really look out for one another. If my work is done, and I look over and I see, you know, one of my comrades, I'll walk over and help them. We really just kind of kick in. The goal here is to get it done, mm-hmm. and the mission is the preservation and perpetuation of Southern culinary culture. Mm-hmm. So we want to teach the people who are walking in the store about our culture, how to go back and share that with others from wherever they're from. And in my case, to teach them how to cook our foods with what they have at home from wherever they're from.
Are you finding, Jill, at this point where more and more visitor, I mean, obviously the food and beverage experience is integral to the New Orleans experience. And for those mm-hmm. often when folks come to visit, that's part of why they're here. Mm-hmm. Are you finding that more people from outside the area are making this the museum a stop on their itinerary?
Oh, absolutely. I'm finding, well, in particular, I can't really talk about numbers walking in the door so much. That's not what I'm tracking as much as people who are showing up in class. Mm-hmm. And our classes are becoming increasingly popular. And it's so rewarding because, I mean, so many people show up in a cooking class and they're so intimidated by this activity. And for me, it's just second nature.
Right.
And to be able to take that mystique away for them. And, if you know, I'll teach them one of my life's greatest accomplishments is I can push a roux to one shade below black in about 12 minutes. And,
ooh,
you know, and
really?
That's working with, you know, 3 cups of flour and 3 cups of oil. Uh-huh. I mean, I can just burn it out and, well, no, not burn it, but, you know, I can get it done. I don't burn it. I'm proud of that accomplishment. But that freaks a lot of people out. I mean, they don't call it Cajun napalm for nothing.
Right.
You know, so I want to teach them how to do that. But if they are still if they're still finding that to be a hair-raising experience, I'll pull out a jar of pre-made roux and say, okay, if you really just can't get your head around this, then just do this. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is you have to do, go home and make these dishes. Make this gumbo or make this jambalaya or make this mock shoe or whatever it is we're teaching them to make. You know, adapt it, make it work for you. If we tell them that it has to be, you know, some regimented and biblical thing with no flexibility, they're not going to do it.
No, of course not.
It's a pain in the neck.
And that's not what recipes really are, right?
No.
In most instances, I realize, you know, like baking is a more of a precise activity.
Precise science.
Yes. But, you know, cooking, and that takes away the joy, right? If you're so rigid, I think.
I think so.
I can't follow a recipe to a
T
like that.
I mean, I'm not going to tell anybody to open up a can of cream soup and dump it in. I mean, that's not my thing. But, you know, that's if that's what some people need to do, okay, whatever. We want you to go home and preserve this culture.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, let's do this. I want to come back and talk about your book because you do have a new cookbook that's just came out, right?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And so we'll talk a little bit about that, talk about the book, and then we'll circle back at the end of the segment, Jill, and talk a little bit about how people can come, you know, find you here at mm-hmm. the museum and some of the programming.
Absolutely.
And things like that we haven't touched on yet. So, friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. This is Brian Diaz. I'm happy to be here with you today. As I mentioned, we are at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and we are chatting with Jill Benson, who is the Director of Culinary Programs and a cookbook author, and she has a great new cookbook out that we are going to get into. It's an interesting journey looking at the heritage of Louisiana cooking, and I think in a pretty novel way. So that's what we're going to do. Take a little break here on the show, friends. Come on back.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. It's football and festival season, and there's no better way to enjoy Sazerac Rye than in a pothole cocktail. Just fill up a glass with ice and your favorite root beer and add 2 ounces of Sazerac rye for a truly tasty toddy. Named after the city's most iconic of inconveniences, the pothole is proof that New Orleans never takes itself too seriously. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc.
a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
The French Market is a place where history is made fresh daily. From the historic Upper Pentalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving Farmers Market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market, making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, babe.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickey Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickey Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
Oh, well, I'm sitting here la-la waiting for my ya-ya. Oh, sitting here la-la waiting for my ya-ya.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Yep, we are here chatting with Joel Benson, who is the Director of Culinary Programming here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We talked about her background, talked a little bit about some of the programming here at the museum and how she found herself here. And as we mentioned, she's a cookbook author. And Jill, you have a brand new cookbook out called Louisiana's Tables, A Culinary Heritage Tour. And it's a neat book, and I think your approach is really cool. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, thanks. I've written several cookbooks, so this publisher, it's Great Texas Line, and the imprint that published the book is Savory House Press. So the publisher approached me, and I have many, many recipes on my hard drive, let's just say that. I've worked with a lot of chefs over the years, I've written cookbooks, I've been a dining columnist forever, I write about culinary culture, and I also cook, so there's a lot going on there. So he approached me and he said, well, what if you were to take many of the what you already have, how would you categorize that to teach people about Louisiana cuisine? So I thought about that, and I have spent a lot of time all over the state. So I ended up breaking it into, was it 5 or 6 different regions?
I think it was 6, right?
It's 6?
I remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
We might need to go back and double check that. So it was a lot of work, and it wasn't really supposed to be a lot of work. He said, hey, you can just put this together with what you have. It's going to be easy. It'll be a quick turn. Well, I really should have known my own personality. I'm really finicky about making sure everything is accurate, and then I needed to make sure that every region was completely flushed out with recipes that represented every region. And then, mm-hmm. Oh, wait, I have to explain every recipe. So it needs a header. And then, so what was supposed to be a quick project really turned into something that took forever. But the result is it's a really good history book in addition to being a good recipe book. There aren't a lot of pictures in here, but there's a lot of information. So this is the easiest example is, where as you travel around Louisiana, and I broke this up based on settlement patterns. So the chapters are broken into settlement patterns. Something like gumbo will change dramatically. So a New Orleans Creole gumbo tends to have a roux. Well, Leah Chase says that you're to cook the roux until it's the color of Leah Chase. And she says, I don't know how white people know what color to cook their roux to. She has said that. So you want to cook the roux till it's a shade of like a nice robust cafe au lait or a peanut butter color. Mm-hmm. And then a New Orleans gumbo, it will have, it's not going to be a really heavy roux. So the ratio is going to be maybe 1 one cup of roux, that peanut butter cup or colored roux, to about a gallon of liquid. And then it's usually loaded down with shellfish, and then you'll see okra and tomatoes. Okra would have been introduced by the enslaved West Africans, and tomatoes were used by people in New Orleans because they were available. They grew abundantly in New Orleans. They would also have been available through the port. Whereas the Prairie Cajun people who settled what we, the area that we would know as Lafayette, they didn't really have access to tomatoes then. And their culinary culture was heavily reliant on smoked meat. So smoked pork in particular. So a real Prairie Cajun gumbo is a very dark roux, and it's very, very heavy. And the ratio of roux, at least when I'm making gumbo, the ratio of roux to liquid would be about 4 cups of roux that's one shade above black to about a gallon of liquid.
Wow, right.
So it's heavy, and it's thick, and it has a velvet texture, and it's rich. And it's reliant on usually some sort of poultry or game and then smoked meat.
And you're getting more of that fat content from the meat cooking out into it, right?
Yeah, and it's a really heavy, heavy dark roux.
Yeah.
And then Bayou Cajun people who would be more like, you know, home a Terrebonne area, they make what's known as a river gumbo. So again, it's about 1 cup of very dark roux to about a gallon of liquid, but they're throwing everything in there. They'll throw in game or some sort of poultry. There's usually some kind of smoked meat, sausage, and they're throwing in seafood. You don't usually see okra or tomatoes popping up in there, though.
There are a lot of people that will tell you, especially from that part of the world, right, when you say putting tomatoes in gumbo, and it's like you've sinned against
the mother, Cajuns, right? Just think that
it's just the craziest thing ever.
They just think that that's dreadful.
Uh-huh.
But whereas Creoles, New Orleans food, they're all about the okra and tomatoes together in a gumbo.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you move upwards into the state, it changes more. The Native American influence really becomes profound in the middle of the state, around the Natchitoches area. And you'll see some okra coming back in there, but not so. And it's thickened. They're also using filet.
Yeah, and I was just going to ask you that question because I think a lot of people don't know that's where the use of filet comes from, the Native American.
Yeah,
cultures.
It was just, and they would have gone out and just pulled leaves off of a sassafras tree and then crushed them between their hands and dumped them into the pot, and that's how they would have thickened their gumbo. So, because there was also a real African-American influence there, you might see roux and filet coming in together or alone based on whatever season you're in. And then moving further, up into the northeastern part of the state, there's a big hunting community. You'll see a lot of game coming into their gumbos, and then move over to the west. And sometimes you're even seeing, red beans or other things moving into the gumbo. And there's more of a southwestern feel going on. So it's interesting, and people in other states are flabbergasted by that, how just based on our settlement patterns, things will change so much even in one dish.
Well, and we know, Jill, too. I mean, my wife grew up in the area. She grew up in Araby and St. Bernard Parish, and her mom's family is actually Nicaraguan descent. So there was a lot of influence of Nicaraguan Central American cooking in what she ate. But then also, as we know everywhere here, everybody has the family recipe, right?
Absolutely.
And that's obviously dictated by the settlement pattern to a degree, right? And I think a lot of people who are not from this area also have a hard time getting their head around that idea that you can go two doors down and how they make their
Absolutely.
Gumbo is different than how you make it.
Yeah, and I address that in the book, too. It's really, everybody's mama or everybody's grandmother makes the best. And, that's just indisputable. And then this was the first time, I was involved in some sort of gumbo cook-off. And I've always just adored Paul Prudhomme. I have my father's first edition copy of Louisiana Kitchen. That was Paul Prudhomme's first book. It was signed to me and my dad. It's held together by rubber bands. And I'm not kidding you, I grab it if I have to evacuate. It's that treasured a possession. I mean, I've pretty much memorized everything in it, but it's just such an important thing to me. And I'd met Paul Prudhomme before, but I was at this gumbo competition, and his publicist said, "Well, do you want your gumbo with rice or do you want it with potato salad?" I said, "Potato salad." But I mean, what are you going to say? It's Paul Prudhomme. And I said, and she said, "I'm just going to give it to the way that Chef Paul likes it here." And she flops in a big blob of potato salad. And I was like, okay. And it was really delicious. And everyone that has that freaks out over just how delicious it is. But it's that cool, creamy counterpart, mm-hmm. kind of mixed with this hot, you know, his is a real Cajun style gumbo, so it's that's pretty assertive. It really works well. It works together, but that's a German influence,
right? Right.
And the Germans settled just west of New Orleans in what we know as Laplace or Des Allemands, which mm-hmm. means the Germans. Mm-hmm. So, but they were brought here. I don't know if you know this story. Liz tells this one well. You know, the French, when they started to populate this colony, they were bringing in, they weren't bringing in fine craftsmen. They were bringing in, they were emptying the prisons. They were bringing in perhaps some ladies of the evening and, some pickpockets or maybe some increasingly unsavory people, but they didn't really have culinary skills. Mm-hmm. So they were going to be reliant on others here. But they also, because they were coming from a European heritage, they wanted things like bread. None of these people knew how to make bread.
Right. Okay.
So they started calling on people of German heritage who had these skills, bread making, sausage making, and they came to the New World. And that's why our sausage making traditions were brought to us by the Germans.
Right.
And the infancy of our baking traditions were brought to us by the Germans and then refined by other cultures who came.
Right.
Or that came. Culture and, who,
and,
culture
and,
then.
And beer, too, in this part of the world. Mm-hmm. It was
absolutely.
All the German beer makers.
It's all German.
Well, let's do this, Jill. Can you stick around? We'll do one more segment because this is sure. all really fascinating. And I want to talk a little bit more about some of the regions in the book and okay. some of these transitions of the settlement patterns you're talking about. Friends, we're chatting with Jill Benson, who is a director of culinary programming here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And we're talking about her latest cookbook, Louisiana's Tables, a culinary history tour. Check it out. We're going to tell you how you can find the book too after the break. Come on back. Wow, when she showed in nation. Wow, creation. We don't bow down on nobody's ground. But I will love to hear them call the Vivian Ring. The golden eagle. Wow, magnolia. The little red, white, and blue. The pretty monogram hunters. And we don't bow down. On nobody's ground, but I will love to hear them call the Indian ring. And here comes the spy ball, flag ball. Check out the crazy wild man. The wild is in the lowland. We love our queen, Queen of New Orleans. But I will love to hear them call us Indian ring.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's Southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu,
life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
We'll be right back.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for tuning in today, friends. Very interesting conversation we're having here with Jill Benson of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We're talking about her latest cookbook. And Jill, you, as we talked about in the last segment, you broke the cookbook down, dividing up the state into, I think, six, is that where we are? Five or six regions, right?
Yep.
And then looking at some of the history and some of the traditions, some of the recipes and these sorts of things. And we're going to talk a little bit about New Orleans.
Okay.
Go figure. We're in New Orleans.
Yeah,
it makes sense.
Yeah, I know. Wouldn't it make sense? So, you know, as I was asked to put this book together based on things that recipes I'd already fooled with in the past, obviously some of the recipes that appear in here are things from the classes that I teach at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I teach the classes with our executive director and founder, Liz Williams. And I teach the technical part of the class, and Liz teaches the history part of the class, and then we kind of flip-flop things, and we just have this little dog and pony show going on. And we, you know, because we have a very fluid and friendly relationship, we're able to engage those who are in our classes, and we always have a good time, and our classes aren't, you know, hokey or, you know, we're not going to talk to you about a swamp monster or anything. We really try to give a strong foundation on how to make these iconic dishes and then adapt them for wherever it is that you live. But we also want people to leave with the information on why we eat these dishes and where they came from. So right now we have three classes that we alternate around, and we can do specialty classes too. But the Taste of New Orleans class, we teach that every Monday, and that class is a remoulade salad. And we teach the technique on remoulade salad and how you can adapt that with whatever protein it is that you might need. And the history of remoulade, a brief history on remoulade. When the French came here, they brought their culinary traditions with them. And the foundation for their culinary culture is the French mirepoix, onion, celery, and carrot. But there were no carrots growing in the swamp. There were no carrots to be found in the New World, but there were these green things, those being bell peppers. So they just kind of subbed them in, and you'll see them do this over and over again. Onions, bell pepper, and celery became the Creole mirepoix, which is also known as the Trinity. And then this remoulade sauce, this thing they called remoulade, it was nothing like a French remoulade. A French remoulade, because they had domesticated poultry by this point, it was made with eggs, and it was reliant on dairy products. Well, there was none of that in the New World, but they found mustard seeds, and they could, you know, get oil out of various plants. Mm-hmm. And so they assembled this thing that's red and spicy and pungent and has a base of Trinity in it, and they call that remoulade sauce too. And then they also have this French remoulade. So it leads to a lot of confusion.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, so we teach remoulade sauce. We teach that.
So you go juxtapose the two against each other and show people
No, we don't. Okay. We just teach a Creole remoulade.
Okay.
We talk about the differences. And then we have a Cajun jambalaya. And that is, it's a Creole jambalaya.
Okay.
So we include tomatoes in that, fresh tomatoes. That's the backbone of our jambalaya. Never canned. Stuff. And then that is, and then we finish it out with bananas foster. So the remoulade was brought to us by one of the nations that settled here. Jambalaya just kind of evolved, and bananas foster is a chef-driven concoction.
Because the bananas coming in through the port in New Orleans.
Right? When the Brennan family had Brennan's Vieux Carré, What was the chef's name?
Oh, I'm drawing a blank on that too.
I say his name a thousand times a day.
Don't worry about it. But it's okay.
That was invented.
So we have bananas all over the place.
We had a ton of bananas, and Brennan's needed a dessert put together for a dignitary,
mm-hmm.
and that was Mr. I believe his name was Richard Foster, who was the president of Foster Awning Company. So Ella Brennan was charged with working with the chef, Paul Blanger. There we go, Chef Paul Blanger.
Okay. Yep.
And in about 30 minutes, she had to come up with this dessert that remains iconic to this day. Mm-hmm. So that was a chef invention. So we really kind of go from what just showed up to what evolved to a chef-driven invention in that class. And then we also teach, on alternating Thursdays, a Creole-Italian class because Liz's family heritage is Sicilian. So many people do not realize what the Sicilians brought to us. At one time in the 1920s, there were more people speaking the Sicilian dialect in New Orleans than in any place else in the world outside of Palermo.
Wow, yeah.
And
a lot of people confuse our Creole Italian cooking and Sicilian cooking are very different.
Well, they are very different. I mean, it's, you know, the Creole red gravy that I teach in our classes, and Liz and I talk about this with the class, and we provide her grandmother's tomato sauce recipe. Mm-hmm. And juxtapose that. We don't cook that one, but we, you know, compare the recipes with Creole red gravy. Well, there's no self-respecting Italian grandmother who's ever going to thicken her sauce with a roux. And this starts with a dark roux. Not a lot of it, but it's there as a structure and it adds a lot of flavor. And then Trinity's in there, and no self-respecting Italian grandmother's fooling with green bell peppers either.
Right.
So, I mean, you can see the amalgamations of these cultures, and we finished that class off with snowballs because we have a great number of snowball machines here, and we make snowball syrups. But it was the Sicilians that brought us our snowball traditions, and a lot of people don't realize that either. So there are huge contributions there. And then the other class we teach on alternating Thursdays, and by the way, this book includes recipes for so many of these things. It's our Cajun class, mm-hmm. and we start the class with a fresh corn mock shoe. And that's flavored with tasso. And we're very, very proud, I have to say this. Our charcuterie sponsor is Wayne Jacobs Smokehouse in Laplace.
Okay.
Their story is incredible. Their products are just, you know, we find no comparison to anyone else. They're just, their history is incredible.
Do me a favor, because I don't want to take, we have about 2.5 minutes left. So we doing the Cajun class and go through. But why don't we tell people a little bit about, how can we connect with the classes?
Yeah.
And all that?
All right, so if you are interested in a class at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, you can visit us at southernfood.org, and you can sign up for classes there. Classes are offered on Mondays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Each is 3 courses and includes a full guided, curated tour of the museum.
Wow, yeah.
So it's a great deal. The price of classes range from, I believe it's $45 to $55, but it's a great value. And you also get a takeaway from the class. And as a gift from us. It's either a spice or a book or something like that.
Okay, cool.
And so you can sign up online. If you're interested in a private class, we offer those as well. Or, you know, either 2 people in a private hands-on class, or, you know, if you want a private class for a group, or, you know, some, we've had requests for, you know, wedding rehearsal dinners or night before wedding dinners or whatever. I mean, we can do whatever to accommodate
you.
Okay.
And where can we find your latest and greatest cookbook?
I do not have a total distribution list, so I'm just going to tell people
come
to the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. It is, we have an abundance of them right at the front desk, and if I'm around, I'll be happy to sign it for you.
That's really cool. Jill, thank you so much, and we'll do this again soon, because what I'd like to do is maybe we'll spend a little bit more time talking about the different classes and maybe get into some of the regions a little bit further.
Absolutely,
it'd be a pleasure. That'd be great. Jill, thank you very much. It was very interesting chatting with you, and thank you for the hospitality as well. Friends, we were just chatting with Jill Benson, cookbook author, director of culinary programming here at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I thank them for having me here today. We'll have a good show lined up for you next week. We'll talk a little bit more about that online, so check us out on Facebook and all that good stuff. And hope everyone has a great week and a great weekend coming up. So as we always like to say, be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until then, cheers, y'all.